This Texas Matters podcast is brought to you by TechPont, a San Antonio company that uses cutting-edge digital technology to elevate marketing and advertising campaigns.
From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, the heat is on, global warming is undeniable, and it's making summer in Texas literally more deadly.
This increase in heat waves is part of a larger trend, and it's going to get worse.
The sea is climbing, the rate of sea level rise is speeding up, and Texas coastlands are becoming submerged.
The day of reckoning is now. This is not something we can push off into the future.
And how your food choices impact climate change. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. July 2019 isn't over yet, and already it's been charted as the hottest month ever recorded. The previous record holder was June 2019, just last month. The fact is that there is global warming, that the Earth is getting hotter. That is an unimpeachable fact, despite the claim by some, like President Donald Trump, that global warming is a hoax. It is not. And the rise in global temperatures has consequences. Weather patterns are being disrupted. That impacts economies and causes food shortages for vulnerable populations. It's driving a global migration trend that is evident at the Texas southern border. And in Texas, the forecast is hotter days, more of them, and reaching record-breaking mercury levels. The higher temperatures will increase the number of heat-related deaths and disrupt the state's agriculture and ranching. Texas is among a string of deep south and southwestern states that will experience the worst effects of climate change. A recent study published in the journal Environmental Research Communications reveals that due to man-made climate change, the summers will keep getting hotter and hotter. Christy Dahl with the Union of Concerned Scientists is one of the authors of that report.
Texas is no stranger to extreme heat, of course, and probably for most people in Texas, heat's just part of life. So in cities like Austin and Houston and Dallas, you're already used to having about 30 days of really hot days when the heat index exceeds 100 degrees. So that's a lot of extreme heat by our country's standards. But as our climate continues to warm, Texas's heat is expected to go from simply part of life to actually life-threatening. What we'd be looking at in Dallas, for example, would be by the middle of this century, instead of seeing about 30 days with the heat index above 100, the city would see about 90 days. So that's the equivalent of 3 months worth of days with that dangerous level of heat. We'd also see the expansion of what we call off-the-charts days in Texas. So these are days that are so hot that they exceed the National Weather Service's heat index scale. We literally can't reliably calculate a heat index or a feels-like temperature. So what we see is that by mid-century in Texas, we could be seeing 4 or 5 of these days per year.
This has health consequences. This can take people's lives. Heat-related deaths, that's a weather-related death that people don't normally calculate or notice. Here we talk a lot about when people die from flooding and catastrophic events, but actually heat is the number one contributor to that stat?
That's right. So heat is each year among the deadliest extreme weather hazards in the U.S. The CDC estimates that there are an average of 600 heat-related deaths every year in our country. But it's often called the silent killer because it doesn't attract the sorts of headlines that a major hurricane might, for example.
Should we be paying more attention? How would we track that?
One of the challenging things with deaths that are attributable to extreme heat is that they're often underreported, and they're not consistently reported from county to county across the country. Part of the reason they're underreported is that extreme heat can exacerbate or make worse underlying health conditions like cardiovascular disease or respiratory issues. So sometimes heat isn't noted as the primary cause of death. It might be cardiovascular disease, right? But it was exacerbated by that heat. This increase in heat waves is part of a larger trend, and it's going to get worse. So we need to be doing more to keep people safe when it is extremely hot. We know that most heat-related deaths are preventable. And so we need to be taking those preventative actions to make sure that people are safe.
It can get so hot at times that even airplanes are not able to take off from the airport?
That's right. There are limits in terms of airplane takeoffs for certain types of airplanes. And we've seen in Phoenix a couple of years ago, for example, it became too hot for the planes to take off. Recently, there was a heat wave in the San Francisco Bay Area. And at the airport, we saw that a jetway sank into the tarmac because the tarmac got so hot that it basically deformed and created a pothole that the jetway sank into. So those are just a couple of the many ways that heat can affect the infrastructure around us that we all depend on.
If we have these heat conditions that your report forecast, then that could have a long-term impact on air travel. I mean, it could be a regular thing. Like the airport's going to have to shut down today because it's too hot. The air is too thin. There's no lift for the planes.
That's right. It would increasingly affect our air travel, but also our travel by road and rail, because some of the same issues that affect airports when it's extremely hot. That's the heating and deformation of the tarmac also apply to roads. Our roads were designed with materials that were considered appropriate for the climate at the time that they were built. But increasingly, we could see conditions that are well outside the bounds of what we've historically had. And so those materials aren't designed to withstand those climate conditions. Similarly, with rail travel, we see when it's extremely hot, rails can buckle or deform, and so that can affect our train travel and movement of freight across the country as well.
We've had heat waves before. Heat waves are not new, but it seems like what you're talking about are these massive heat waves that will cover more geographic area. They're bigger in size, happen with greater frequency, have more intensity, they'll be even hotter, and then they'll have a longer duration. So is that the forecast?
That's right. So we've always had heat waves. It's just a normal part of our weather system, and we wouldn't expect that to change in the future, that we would have some days that are cooler and some days that are warmer. But what we see is that in Texas, by the end of the century, for example, the summer season would have 160 days with a heat index above 90 degrees. So 160 days is more than 5 months, right? And those days wouldn't necessarily be consecutive. That means that, you know, they could be spaced out throughout the summer. But nevertheless, that represents a huge portion of the year. And so at that point, it's difficult to think of calling them heat waves. And it's just become simply the background climate that we live with.
What would this mean for our zones when we consider one area to be, tropical, subtropical, arid, semi-arid? Are we going to have to reclassify?
We could potentially see shifting of climate zones. This is something that has been noted for the climate change that's occurred to date, that our plant zones are changing in the U.S., and we're starting to see plants that were only comfortable in our more southern latitudes in the country, shifting northward. And the planting season is changing for a lot of the plants that we've grown up knowing and loving. So it is possible that we would see shifts in our general climate zones in Texas and throughout the country.
This is happening due to climate change, carbon in the atmosphere, the retention of heat on the planet, and this is something that it's not being addressed.
Yes, right now in our country, we're not adequately addressing the fact that we need to stop burning fossil fuels and we need to reduce our overall carbon emissions. The temperatures that we're currently living with and that we'll be living with for the next few decades are due in large part to human activity in the United States. So we need to be stepping up as cities and states but really also as a nation, to be bringing down our carbon emissions as fast as we can.
Kristi Dahl is an author of a report by the Union of Concerned Scientists titled Killer Heat in the United States, The Future of Dangerous Hot Days. It shows that heat waves in Texas are going to be getting worse, last longer, and happen with greater frequency. They will be taking a greater toll in lives and the economy. This is caused by man-made climate change. The sea level off the coast of Texas is up a foot and a half from where it was 70 years ago. That's according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. That sea level rise is caused by several factors, including the sinking of coastland from groundwater pumping. But it's also driven by the heating of the oceans and the melting of massive sheets of ice in the polar regions. So the result is eroding beaches, the destruction of wetlands, and tides getting closer and closer into communities and cities on the coast. To combat this, Texas and other coastal states are preparing structures to hold back tide waters, and that's not going to be cheap. It's estimated to cost upwards to $1 trillion, and even then, there will be areas that will be surrendered to the sea. Already, sea level rise has cost Texas homeowners almost $80 million in potential property values. That's according to a study by the First Street Foundation and Columbia University. Another report by the Center for Climate Integrity points out that rising cost of dealing with sea level rise is more than what governments had predicted because the ocean level is climbing at a faster rate than had been expected, and natural barriers are no longer adequate to protect coastal communities. Richard Wiles is the executive director of the Center for Climate Integrity.
What our study shows is that within the next 20 years, literally hundreds of communities around the country, you're going to have to start making major investments in coastal defenses if they want to keep infrastructure and private property protected from sea level rise and very routine storm surge, the storms that happen every year. You know, as the seas begin to rise, those annual storms are launched from a higher platform. So there's just no question that within the next decade, and certainly within the next two, major investments are going to have to be made in communities all across the country.
So paint me a picture. Is this a gradual increase in where the ocean's going to be creeping into inland, or how does that work?
Yeah, I mean, that's basically it. It's the ocean is just continuing to rise, and that affects communities that are, on anywhere where there's a tide, essentially, is where this is going to affect people. So, you know, the tidal shoreline of the United States that is impacted is roughly 50,000 miles. There are states like Texas that have many thousands of miles of tidal shoreline, much of which needs to be defended against sea level rise. And a lot of it are places that aren't particularly glamorous, but for the people who live there, they mean, everything. It's every tidal river, every bay, every sound, obviously the ocean-facing properties. It's just what we're trying to point out is that this isn't something we can put off into the future. It's going to affect hundreds of communities and thousands of miles of coastline in states like Texas and all along the Gulf and the Atlantic coast.
How is this being seen today?
Well, I think you're right that people have sort of put it off as though this is something that's going to happen in 2100 or 2080 and they don't have to worry about it, but that's just not the case. The way we did the study was to say we took a very conservative estimate of sea level rise, actually probably less than we will see over the next 20 years. We assumed emissions reductions that are actually better than are happening globally. And then we assumed a very inexpensive way to defend the coast through the sort of the crudest way to do it, with just seawalls and revetments or some kind of physical, simple barrier. Nationwide, we came up with over $400 billion of these kind of defenses that would be needed over the next 20 years. 132 counties with over $1 billion of expenses. And I think it's clear that a lot of those counties don't have that kind of money. And the point we're trying to make is that, this is an expense that's roughly the size of the interstate highway system. We got to build it in half the time that it took us to build that. And that there's really no way we're going to do that if we don't have everybody chipping in, including the polluters, paying their fair share of this. And even then, it's not likely that we will be able to defend, or that we probably even should defend, every coastal community that's going to begin to be underwater a significant number of days a year.
Galveston Island here in Texas, is that going to have to go underwater, or what is that? Do you build seawalls around it? How does that work?
Well, you know, I'm not familiar with the physical geography, but basically that's one of the places that the expense per person there was in the thousands of dollars per person to keep, to keep that community from experiencing, routine multiple days of inundation per year. And what we're simply saying is that, you have some choices. You can either accept that you're going to be inundated increasing number of days on high tides, or you can build defenses against that. And we think in most places they're going to try to build defenses against it. There are very few places that want to retreat, although some will. But, you're going to face difficult choices, and whatever they are, they're going to cost a lot of money. And if polluters aren't paying their fair share, there's just no way we're going to be able to afford it. And no way that if polluters don't pay, there's a lot of communities will be left behind that otherwise wouldn't be left behind, and that, of course, shouldn't be left behind.
Why are the seas rising?
The seas are rising because of CO2 emissions. We've raised the level of CO2 roughly 60% in the past couple hundred years. It's at higher levels than it's been in the past several million years. And the CO2 absorbs heat, and the heat causes oceans to do two things. One, the water expands. Just simply when it warms, it expands, and a significant portion of sea level rise is simply due to what they call ocean thermal expansion from CO2 emissions. And then, of course, in the past several decades, maybe 30 years, there's been a rapid acceleration of glacial ice melt at the poles, and also just from mountain glaciers, all of which are feeding into an accelerating level of sea level rise, so that we're seeing faster sea level rise every year as we move forward.
So the oceans are not a bathtub. We have a lot of forces at play here, gravitational things like that. So areas are going to feel the impact of sea level rise more than others, right?
That is absolutely correct. And the underlying models that we use for this study take into account those local factors, be they ocean currents or the local land subsidence, or in some cases on the West Coast, the land is actually rising, so sea level rise is minimized. So all of those local factors were taken into account when we estimated the cost of protections and the amount of sea level rise that these communities would be facing.
We have a significant portion of our economy positioned on the coastline. That's where we have our refineries, we have our major cities. What does that mean if that's going to be the most vulnerable to sea level rise?
It means that we're going to have to divert hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars, from otherwise useful activity to defending those places, right? It sucks money out of the economy to build these kind of defenses. And if you look at any of the macroeconomic projections of the impact of climate change over the decades into the future, they all show that there will be, some significant impact on overall GDP and overall economic growth and economic health. And this is basically, kind of a very visual way to think about what that is. It's when, you're sucking money out of the economy to do things like this. Sure, we will employ people to build walls, but it's not really obviously the most productive use for this amount of money. But it's just, it's an example of what's coming at us and coming at us fast. And as you say, the majority or certainly a significant portion of the nation's productive industrial infrastructure and the majority of people live on or near the coasts. And so these places in general will be defended, and it will cost us hundreds of billions, if not, it will cost us trillions of dollars to do the complete defending and, to maintain the continuing functioning of the economy and society in a lot of these coastal places. And what we're trying to do is just point out that, the day of reckoning is now. This is not something we can push off into the future. Many communities are already spending hundreds of millions of dollars on this, and that it's just not fair that all of this cost falls on the taxpayers, particularly in smaller communities that don't have large tax bases, will be facing enormous property tax increases to deal with this, and that, you know, polluters need to pay. There needs to be a mechanism, either through the courts or through some other way, to make sure that the, you know, the industries that caused this problem, that knew this problem was coming, and, you know, basically ran a deception campaign for 30 years to convince us all that climate change wasn't real, you know, they need to pay up and help these communities protect themselves.
Richard Wiles is the executive director of the Center for Climate Integrity. They warn that the destructive sea level rise is happening now, and they're looking to draw attention to the scope and gravity of the problem, which threatens major cities and segments of the U.S. population. There's a big difference between a hamburger and a peanut butter sandwich when it comes to climate change. The food choices we make every day have a significant effect on global warming. But the good news is that even small changes to what we eat and buy at the store can add up to real environmental benefits and the reduction of global warming emissions. So how do we eat green? Some food choices, especially when it comes to the protein we consume, have bigger climate change footprints than others. Chris Wharton is the author of a study published in the journal Sustainability that compares food choices and gives them a score according to their environmental impact.
More and more consumers are making choices about food that relate to not only the impact on their health, but the impact of the food on the environment. And how do you help somebody think about those two things simultaneously? So lots of information on food packaging related to nutrition and ingredients and these sorts of things. Rarely is there similar types of information about environmental impact. And so this was sort of a first attempt to take evidence-based information, bring it together, and then deliver some sort of scoring system or ranking system that could help people think about those two things at the same time.
At the score, what does it tell me about what a particular food means for my impact on the environment?
Yeah, great question. So really what it is, it helps you sort of compare one food against another. And so when you look at, so in the paper we have a figure that lists a whole bunch of commonly consumed protein foods in the U.S. And you can look at one food and see that it might have a greater impact on the environment as compared to another based on the protein quality. So to take the extremes in one of the figures in the table, peanuts happen to be the most efficient food, and that means they deliver the best protein quality for the least environmental impact as compared to beef, you know, which is a great protein source, but it unfortunately has, generally speaking, a very significant impact. It's one of the most resource-intensive foods in our food system, right? So if you're looking to maximize the protein quality for the least amount of environmental impact, you may more often choose peanuts as a source of protein as compared to beef.
When I look at this chart and I see that beef really is far and away the number one high scorer food, it really sticks out and makes you think about why are we eating so much beef when and not thinking about what it's doing to the environment.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, I think, hopefully the takeaway from the paper is it allows you to think about a food from a couple different dimensions. And it's not to say that we necessarily need to just eliminate beef from our diet. And that was kind of why I think one of the other points of the paper is that, in fact, if you're interested in not just the healthfulness of foods, but then also environmental impact, you could think of the foods as they're ranked, you know, in this paper as sort of sometimes foods, maybe and anytime foods. In the same way we talk to kids about, you know, foods that you can eat anytime, like say fruits and vegetables, and foods you might only eat sometimes, like desserts and things, you could actually now apply the same sort of concept to protein foods in our diet from an environmental perspective. So beef, let's say you're not really interested in becoming vegetarian or vegan, there's no problem with that. You could just think more along the lines of reducing your consumption of beef, the frequency of it, and increasing your consumption of alternative protein sources in the diet, and, you know, kind of apply that anytime, sometime sort of approach to foods.
But as we enter an era where there's going to be a lot more consideration about trying to reduce what's happening to climate change, mm-hmm. And people are thinking about all of our actions and how we impact where we're going with the environment and the climate and the global warming, should there be some sort of economic offsets that are necessary if people decide they want to have beef?
Yeah, so there are these hidden costs of foods. It's a fraught kind of concern in the sense that we're very lucky to have a food system that is so efficient that delivers us incredibly cheap food. And so the thing that we've been able to now avoid is issues of, say, famine and these kinds of problems that still exist elsewhere in the world. So we're very lucky to have very cheap food. But then what's hidden in that, what's sort of not accounted for in the food itself, then are these externalities, right? These impacts on the environment that can be represented in dollars, but aren't necessarily represented in the cost. I guess there could be policy approaches to build that sort of notion in. We probably don't want to do this, but we could wait for the environment to make that happen anyway. So as we have more droughts, destroy or decrease the yields of feed crops that would go to animals to help produce beef, for example, that would lead to increases in the cost of beef naturally. But probably we want to try to avoid that. And my approach, at least with this paper, is to arm people with more information so that we can, not only from a policy perspective, address climate change, that's absolutely vital, but I also want to provide the opportunity for individuals to make choices about their consumption patterns. I think there's a lot of focus with big global problems on how do we address this in systemic and policy ways, policy-driven ways. And I think that's fundamental, but I worry sometimes that takes away all the agency or even the notion that we as individuals can make important changes too that don't have to be dramatic, but in aggregate can actually lead to impacts on climate change over time. And this is one of those. I think we do have considerable opportunity to make changes in how we eat. I think one of the lessons of this paper too is that when you look at the types of food choices that are most efficient, it's not just plant foods. So if you look at the bottom of one of the figures in the table, you'll see peanuts are there. They're sort of the best. But then you also see tuna and salmon, for example. Even chicken is pretty low in terms of environmental impact for the protein quality you get. And so it's not just about taking perhaps some might consider a sort of a more extreme approach to diet and just completely eliminating foods or becoming vegan. You can actually have a balanced diet, eat plant foods and animal foods, but still have that sort of impact when it comes to environment.
What do you call this score? Is there a shorthand for it?
I guess there's not an easy way to say it. It's the GW Pro score.
Okay, so if I pick up a packet of something at the store and I look at the ingredients, and on there will also be the GW Pro score.
That would be kind of a dream of mine. One thing, you know, this is not necessarily an easily utilizable set of information. It's buried in a scientific paper that's in the scientific literature. But my hope is that we could take information like this and deliver it in a really easily understandable way. And in fact, it could be delivered that way. The way that we created the score was meant to reflect the efficiency of a protein food by serving size. And so the other thing that's really important about protein foods is, of course, we can eat vastly different amounts of it that it would be considered sort of a standard serving size. And so we wanted to develop the score around what is considered a standard serving size so that it reflected what people eat in the real world. And as a result, I think we could easily convert something like this into a system that could be understandable even on food packaging. Generally speaking, I think information given on food packaging could be a lot more easily delivered. And I think this would be a candidate for something like that.
Chris Wharton is a professor at Arizona State University's College of Health Solutions. He is an author of a study, Integrating Protein Quality and Quantity with Environmental Impacts in Life Cycle Assessment. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. And that's where you can find past Texas Matters programs to listen to, and you can find us wherever you get your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.